Well, I'll start while the raffle ticket sales happen. Is it very echoey, this mic? Is it all right?
Yes.
Good. Welcome, all of you, and lots of familiar faces, which is always nice, to one of our Bad All Year events. I'm sure you all know that we're doing 10 of these, and the last one is the festival itself. This is number February, March, April, May, 4. Is that right? Yes, I can count. And we're really grateful to have Jane Caro, who's a participating chair. That means she'll talk about her books as well as the new books by Georgia. Oh, you are good, you two. Well, do I need to tell you what their books are called? I think it's pretty clear. Now, it's all the books. The books will be for sale, actually, except that Jane, you know, the thing about being a bestseller is it means your books sell out sometimes. And Addie's didn't have a single one. But there is one there which somebody could grab, I suppose, and pay for. And there's one of The Mother, which is Jane's first crime book, which is... Oh, it's a library book. Sorry. Oh. Well, I mean, you know, this is... So you can buy the Lyrebird, but they should be available at any good bookshop, and if not, say, come on, this is not good enough. So we're talking today, or you're talking today, about how women call the shots in crime fiction, which is a change from what they used to do. And we have several crime fiction writers here, apart from the three on the podium, which is really good. We're also using these events as fundraising events. So we're selling our tote bags, which you can buy there, but we're also doing a raffle. Three for ten. One for five and three for ten. Yeah, I knew I was going to get that. Oh, yeah, well, yes, go to her, she's good. And we have some book prizes. We also have some wine prizes, courtesy of Tulloch Wines. And if any of you came to the fabulous event in the Hunter Valley, it was really good fun, and we'll be doing another one next year. So no more from me, but lots from Jane, Georgia, and Mercedes.
Thank you, Catherine. I just want to acknowledge that we're meeting tonight on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Now, I've got these two fabulous women sitting here and... they're going to read from their books in a minute, just to give you a taste of, because who in the audience has actually read their books? Quite a few, but the majority have not. And that is my guess at every one of these, that most of the audience have not actually read the book. And so getting a short reading from the authors is actually a really good way to set what we're talking about and give the audience an idea of what the books are like, rather than us talking about something and the audience thinking, I'm getting a gist, but not as clearly as I'd like to. So, but before we get to the readings, I'm going to introduce both Georgia and Mercedes. Now, Georgia Harper isn't just an award-winning crime writer, winner of the Davitt Best Debut Book in 2025, shortlisted for Best Crime Fiction Debut at the evocatively named 2025 Danger Awards. I think that's hilarious. I'm sorry, Catherine, but I think it's funnier than bad.
We're doing our best.
Yes, I know, and Danger was taken. She is a psychologist who has worked with both serious offenders and victim survivors. So, no wonder she's able to get right inside the heads and hearts of her characters. In fact, as we sat here chatting, she was giving me a silent rating on the psychopath register. I think I came out quite high, which is slightly
worrying. I didn't
finish,
but you were edging up.
Georgia lives on the Sunshine Coast, and her latest novel, Dove, is set in rural Queensland. Please welcome Georgia. Mercedes Mercier is also much more than an acclaimed crime writer. She has also worked in the criminal justice system for over a decade. I'd just like to let you all know that I have never worked in the criminal justice system. I am not a psychologist, and indeed a neighbour of mine who's a copper told me he read Lyrebird. He liked it very much, but the police stuff was crap. So I don't know anything about that. But Mercedes and Georgia both do. So she's also worked in the criminal justice system for over a decade. I guess this is a warning to us all that if we ever get involved with the criminal justice system, anyone we come in contact with could be weighing us up for possible inclusion in their next novel. So I think you just need to be on notice about that. Indeed, there were two podcasters in the room who specialise in crime who also have worked for police ministers and things like that. So I'm not making this up. This is true. Mercedes lives in Adelaide, and her latest novel, which we're discussing tonight, Couples Retreat, is set on Kangaroo Island, which is kind of a lifeboat novel set on an island, really, isn't it? Fantastic. So please welcome Mercedes. So, Georgia, do you want to go first with your short reading, A Taste of Dove?
I do, but I have a bit of a bone to pick with you first, Jane.
Oh, why? What have I done now?
I went into Big W the other day looking for Dove, and the bookseller was there, and I said, hey, have you seen Dove? And she's like, she's looking on her phone. She takes me down an aisle, and she's like, there it is. And she's like, have you read The Mother by Jane Kerr? And then she's like, this reminded her of that. And then she just promptly dropped my book and took me to your book. She was very excited.
Can you give me her name? I'd like to send her a check. It is. I was reminded as well. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's a compliment. Ooh, my friend's very loud.
Yes, am I reading? Go. Oh, gee. This is unpracticed. Hang on, I've got to find the spot.
I've heard that before.
Oh, jeez. Sorry to distract me.
Georgia might have more luck.
The worst rumour I've heard from Mona is that I hid the pregnancy and did something to the baby after it was born. I feel a tickling at my scalp now and smile because I know it is dark, pulling my hair. I unfold myself and sit up, watching him waddle over to clack his beak against the bottom of the mirror. I put my hands to my cheeks to wipe away my tears, but they have dried. I hear a woman scream and then realise it's only a goat. After I've upside-down milked Guinevere, stealing glances from the barn to Nathaniel's place to make sure he's not outside, I walk along the creek on the edge of town to quieten my mind. The ground is moist and dragonflies flit between the lamandra and palms. When I hear a flick of water, I follow the V of the ripple until a platypus head nudges the surface. Dark swoops from tree to tree and I say, would you look at that? And he clicks his beak, but I think it's because he's caught a fly. While walking, I remember that I need to pick up a package of seeds, broccoli and cabbage and silver beet to plant for the winter. So I muster the strength to leave the water's edge and meander towards the post office. Hitting the main street with the three pubs and one of everything else, I think what a sweet little place Mablethorpe is, really, with the steep tin roofs and red brick paths hung over with shady trees. I traipse along the footpath, enjoying the scent of the camphor laurels, when Callum McCosker comes striding towards me. We slept together years ago. It was a regrettable encounter, him all grabby and self-interested and full of haste, that made me wonder, God, how is it possible you've had two long-term girlfriends? I've never stopped feeling sorry for Molly and Kate and for the fact we all still have to see his face around town. He's moving at a fast pace, walking straight at me. Is he about to run into me? Instead of skirting off to the edge of the footpath like I normally would, I continue on my path to see what happens. That's when we run right smack bang into each other. We pause awkwardly for a moment, and when it becomes clear neither of us is worse for wear, he says, why didn't you move? He's affronted. Why didn't you move? I ask. You saw me, he counters, and I know you saw me, I say, because you nodded at me right before we collided. He shakes his head and says, Dad's waiting for me in the ute. Watch where you're going next time. I stand there after he walks off. My finger goes to my bandage, flattening out the edge of the fabric that is rolled up. My brain's trying to process what's happened. After a few seconds, my feet begin to move again. I'm coming up to the pub, and Ernest Booth and Percy Van Hoffer walk out the door and down the footpath in my direction. I decide to stay my path again, see what happens. This time, there's no collision. Instead, we stop a metre short of each other in confusion, because they clearly thought I was going to step aside and let them pass before we got too close. I do that now to resolve the standoff, and one of them says, "That's okay, love," as though I'd just apologised. I collect my package as quickly as I can and walk home, taking the road rather than the path along the creek. Nathaniel keeps popping into my head. It seems unreal that only yesterday he had held me by the hair, his body pressed against mine, his spittle hitting my neck, breath like stale beer, as he hissed his threat. As I near my place, I decide to check how many bunches of flowers have sold at the bakery, so I know if I need to make up more this afternoon. Mona has left the flower buckets, sitting out the front of the shop, and I start counting the bunches of dahlias and asters and roses. There's a man and a dark-haired little girl, brown eyes and waves like mine, sitting at one of the outdoor tables. She's eating a jam donut, and the man uses a napkin to wipe mock cream off her nose. "Daddy," she says. "Mm," he replies. "What would you do if Mummy went away for a whole day?" I will myself to look at the buckets, when really I want to watch his face as he answers. "What a question, April," he says. April, August, April, August. Then, after a moment, as though he's reflected on it, he chuckles and said, "She'd better leave a manual, that's all I can say." April is quiet in response. As I turn my back and walk along the footpath towards my gate, I hear her say, "Daddy, what would happen if there was a whole day with no mummies at all?" A loud beep startles me. Nathaniel's ute careers down the road in the direction of his house. Inside the cab, he strains his body towards the open passenger window, his face contorted, giving me the finger. He yells something, but I can't make out what. I'm instantly sick and afraid, and I'm angry too, and the feeling is large and uncomfortably shaped, and I have no place to put it. Then the voice inside me, the still, quiet one, says, "What would happen if there were no men for a day?" Stopping in front of Mona's sign, I hear footsteps approaching on the concrete. Coming from the direction of the church is handsy old Mr. Cushings. He shuffles up the centre of the footpath, eyes roving over me. A grin spreads across his face. I stay right where I am, examine my wall, all 70 metres of it. I have an idea.
Has anyone ever done that? Kept walking, and have you been banged into every time? Funny, isn't it? I have too. Mercedes.
Out on the footpath, Quinn hangs up and scans the area. Two security floodlights spread pools of white onto the ground, a couple of glowing oases amongst the dark bitumen. Beyond the station, the scrubland is like a living being, the wind moving between the branches, first this way, then that, like lungs breathing in and out. Somewhere deep within the canopy, a mouse screams, probably snatched in the talons of a silent owl. Quinn lets her mind wander. What's so important that Blake made the trip over to Kangaroo Island 2 days after she moved? Does he think he can win her back? Or is there something more to it? From the first time Quinn had laid eyes on Blake 8 months ago, he had a hold on her. She'd come across him on Tinder, which she'd reluctantly downloaded at Liz's insistence. His profile pictures showed artfully tousled hair, a moody expression, and a sleeve full of tattoos stretching up one arm. They'd met up for a drink one Thursday night, which turned into many drinks, which turned into tumbling into his bed. He'd been dominating in the bedroom, something Quinn had never experienced before. For once in her life, someone else was telling her what to do, and her only role was to obey. She didn't have to stand on her own two feet. She didn't have to be strong and independent. She'd found the lack of control exhilarating and strangely freeing. Outside the bedroom, he told her constantly how beautiful she was, how funny, how clever, how impressive. He wanted to touch her all the time, grasping her hand when they were at the movies, slinging an arm around her waist when they walked into a restaurant. At night, he slept with his feet intertwined with hers, or one of his large hands cupping her breast, as if he couldn't bear to be separate from her, even in sleep. He promised to always look after her, so she wouldn't have to worry about her finances anymore. Everything they had would be joined. She'd never have to go through life alone again. They were a team, unbreakable. It was Blake and Quinn against the world. She'd never realise how much she'd longed for that until he'd said it, how tired she was of always working things out on her own, of never having a safety net. The first couple of months with Blake were a bubble of bliss. Quinn fell for him hard and fast. But then the controlling behaviours started to creep in. So subtle, so insidious, that it took even her, who was studying a number of modules on domestic violence at the academy, a long time to notice. It started with negative comments about her parents. Blake thought her parents didn't like how much they were supporting her, that they spent too much time together. When Quinn confronted her parents, they agreed that this was how they felt. Blake had said he didn't feel comfortable seeing them until they had a better opinion of him. She started visiting them less and less, a combination of not wanting to put up with their judgment and Blake's silent reproach whenever she came home from seeing them. Next had been Liz. That had been a slower process. A sly comment here and there about how Liz was jealous of their relationship, how she felt threatened by Blake. Shouldn't Liz, as Quinn's best friend, be happy for her, want the very best for her? So why was she asking questions about him, trying to turn Quinn off him? She just wanted Quinn all for herself. Quinn stopped reaching out to her, replying to only every second or third message, made excuses about being too busy to see her. Blake told her how worried he was about her having social media when she was going to be a police officer, how easy it would be for someone she'd arrested or fined to track her down online and do something nefarious. He couldn't bear the thought of it. All he wanted was for her to be safe. It was his job to look out for her after all. So she'd deleted her Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok accounts. His criticisms had felt so caring and well-meaning in the beginning, but they became constant and much less caring. They'd changed from, you look so much more beautiful when you wear your hair down, to, you should wear your hair down, it hides your big ears. From, you should wear a jacket, it's cold outside, to, I picked out your coat, no one wants to see those pale arms. He slowly stripped away her self-esteem so that she became emotionally ever more reliant on her. Because of the way she'd been brought up, she didn't have anyone to turn to for advice during that period. Not that she had anyone left, Blake had made sure of that. Things only came to a head when, one evening, Liz surprised Quinn outside the academy. Quinn had been cancelling on catch-ups for months, but that night Liz had dragged her to a pub and over a bottle of house white explained how scared she was for her. Liz had broken down completely, which Quinn had never seen her vivacious best friend do before. It had shocked her enough to listen. It had taken another 2 weeks to allow herself to see her relationship with Blake for what it was, and a further week to finally build up the courage to break it off with him. Something moves out of the corner of her eye and she turns to look. And there, caught in the lights from the police station, is Blake. He's in all black, jeans, sneakers, a knitted jumper, and a beanie flattening his dark fringe against his forehead. His face lights up when he sees her, and he walks quicker, his shoes barely making a sound against the pavement. Quinn watches him approach and shivers. The scream of the mouse when it was snatched by the silent predator reverberates in her mind.
Very powerful, I'm sure you'll agree, and both their books are riveting and terrifying. And both the books have, as we can hear there, strong feminist themes. And I think this is the topic of this panel, really, crime fiction, particularly that written by women, has become increasingly feminist. I mean, if you think of Agatha Christie, I love Agatha Christie, frankly, but it's not very feminist, apart from the fact that Miss Marple's the smartest person wherever she is. Do you think that the increasing feminism of crime fiction, what do you think that's to do with? Why? Why has it become increasingly feminist? And why is crime increasingly becoming a female preferred genre? Like, women buy a lot of crime, they watch a lot of crime, they listen to crime podcasts. What's that about?
I think with the latter, there is some research around, you know, women preparing themselves, so becoming aware of the things that they need to look out for so as not to become victims of crime. And I think a lot of the consumption of that content is probably driven by that sort of, you know, I mean, I think for me, you kind of store stuff away, don't you? Like, oh yeah, like, if don't do that because that, and don't, you know, and I suppose it's under...
So they're how-to manuals.
I suspect they are to some extent, but it's somehow blanketed in a weird type of entertainment. I always feel strange, even when I say to people, I'm glad you enjoyed my book. I feel a little funny about that because there is something about crime, even true crime, that we are drawn to, but I'm reluctant to call it entertainment. But yet there is something in addition to that protecting ourselves and learning those lessons that draws us maybe the darker part of humanity
I think we know that we are predominantly the victims of crime, so it is a self-interest thing, it's a research thing, it's a self-interest thing, it's a maybe a way of experiencing in a way that we can control it as well. We know we pick up a crime novel, we know most of the time it's going to wrap up, there's going to be justice of some sort at the end, which, you know, often doesn't happen in real life.
Yeah, I think you're right. I remember hearing once a psychologist on the radio talking about safe danger, that one of the reasons that we slow down if there's a car accident is not because we're ghouls, it's actually because having a car accident is a realistic possibility, and therefore we need to kind of rehearse what that might be like. And every time I think about women and how much we want to read about crime, watch crime, etc., I think it's safe danger. It's a way of us playing with our worst fear, and almost it is a how-to manual in a way. And certainly in my book, The Mother, I was very careful that I wanted to put in there the red flags to look out for as you find yourself in a coercive relationship. But it's also, I think, it's kind of a how to arm yourself emotionally. How do you survive if you're in a terrible car accident, or if you are attacked or raped or threatened in some way? It's fascinating to think that women... But the other thing that's happened is that we've always enjoyed crime, but the big change is that now it's not only that women are often the victims of crimes in crime novels, but they're also the detectives. They're also the solvers of the crime. And that's, I mean, okay, Miss Marple is a clear example of an early female detective, but there's not that many, and suddenly there's an explosion of women detectives.
Do you think that that is related to an explosion of women fiction writers and women crime writers, that women are typically writing women solving the crime?
I think it's certainly got something to do with that, but I think it's also there's an unease with having been rescued by men, whereas I think in the past that was almost desired. I think that one of the things that's changed for women is that we don't want our female heroes to need a knight in shining armour to come and fix things for them.
Absolutely, I agree. I make a conscious decision in every one of my books that I write that my female protagonist is never saved by a man. She always saves herself.
Do you think, though, that when you read the women detectives and the women rescuers, they are often, there's often that, I often see this kind of stereotypical masculine traits presented in them, but I also see a bit of an internal war within them around those kind of traits. I don't know, what do you, in terms of the police, so with Quinn, for example?
Yeah, I think so. Quinn's, I was interested in writing a character who was a little bit more like me, was sort of filled with self-doubt, and I think a lot of the time she does what us women do, in that she is very competent. She's a good police officer. She's got the skills, she's got the education, but she doubts herself constantly, and she doubts every decision she makes, even normal good ones.
When I first met Mercedes, she's like, just tell me what to do. And I'm like, okay, Mercedes, sure.
I was like, please just take this decision out of my life. I make so many decisions. I just needed, hence why we were wearing these t-shirts, because that's one less decision to make today. What do I wear?
Well, you actually put those feelings into Quinn's mind and recognise that makes her vulnerable to a coercive controller. That desire to not take charge is something that I think coercive controllers may sniff out and see an opportunity.
Yes, that's a great point.
Mm. I agree with that.
With Dove, I mean, your protagonist is, in a way, she's like Quinn, but she's living right out on the edge, and she does something incredibly provocative as a kind of way of reasserting control, I think, after Nathaniel, who you mention in your reading, and what she experiences from him and what she senses his poor, downtrodden, terrified wife is experiencing. So it's interesting that coercive control is in both of your novels very strongly. What do you think, why were you driven to write a woman who pushes and pushes and pushes to a very, very vulnerable and dangerous place?
You don't know the story of how I came up with that book, do you?
I do not. Please tell us. I'm sure lots of the audience don't either.
So Dove is set in 1993, but when I was editing my first novel, What I Would Do to You, I lived on a tiny property by myself, and I try not to draw too much from, you know, my own life, but this one is quite the literal drawing of it in this particular way. I had an incident with a man that I didn't know well, and it's not the same sort of thing as what happens in the book, but I felt really deeply unsettled by what happened, and it wasn't something that I could take to the police. And at the same time as that happened, while I was in edits, I was kind of distracting myself a little bit by going down this social media rabbit hole, and it was 2022, 23. And I don't know if anybody has come across it, but there was a viral social media thread that asked, what would you do if there were no men for a day? And thousands and thousands and thousands of women answered that question. And they weren't the answers that you might think that they were. They weren't sort of like the man-hating answer. Well, I mean, there were some, but it was, a lot of it just spoke to that real desire for just simple freedom and safety. And what really I loved about that question was that I think for most of us, you know, we have men and boys in our lives that we love, and we absolutely don't want them to disappear. But the 24-hour question means that then they're gone for a day and they come back. And so I think it allows you to have this sort of thought exercise where you remove the system of oppression for a day, and you also remove, I guess there's often that question about like what men might harm me, what men. So by removing all men, you don't need to ask what men, you are just instantly safer for a day. So anyway, I was reading this thread, and then this thing happened with this man, and I felt so, it was something that made me really, really angry. Like I really, and what really made me a bit sick when it happened was what I did, which was I really flipped into a bit of a, I'm going to placate you. because I'm actually not angry. I'm actually glad because it's a survival mechanism. But everything inside me wanted to be like the opposite, but I knew I had to do that. And I was just so angry at myself, but I also knew that it was the best decision at the time. And I had a massive front fence and I was standing outside it and I was like, you know what I'm going to do? Going to get a big can of spray paint and I'm going to write that question across my front fence and I'm going to invite women to come and write their answers on there. And I'm a little bit prone to impulsive decision making, Jane, and I told a couple of friends, I'm like, I'm going to do this thing, and they're like, Georgia, don't you do that. And I didn't do it. I calmed down, I didn't do it. But a couple of years later, I was like, oh, I need a book idea. And Dove, the character, had been in my head for a really long time. And I actually want to, if we have a chance later, I want to tell you a really cool thing that just happened to do with her as a character. But, when I was like, Dove could do it. And I deliberately set it back 30-ish years as, I guess, a question to the reader around, I've taken a modern, actual real-world viral social media question but set it back then as a question about what has changed or hasn't.
It's interesting. So in a way, maybe one of the reasons that women like to write crime fiction, to read crime fiction and to draw female characters is we can be a bit braver in our fiction than we can in real life, and we don't have to placate because we are in control of what we're writing and what we're reading and what we're experiencing. And so often in life we have to placate because we're vulnerable if a bigger, stronger man wants to attack us. Because, of course, the other question that went viral just last year was, who would you rather be in the forest with, a man or a bear? And women all said the bear. And so I think, you know, these viral questions are another way that women can make clear to the world, and particularly to men, that we do live in fear. I mean, I notice myself that if my husband goes away and I'm at home on my own, I will go around and check all the locks and, you know, make sure that everything's secure. I don't do that when he's there. I never even think about it. No. So it's...
Do you trust him to protect you?
Yeah. Well, no, I just think... there's a man in the house, it's okay, I trust him, I'll be all right. But when I'm on my own, there's a sense of vulnerability.
I have a wild safety tip that I think every time I share this, people are like, that's a great idea. When I lived on a property by myself, like where no one could hear you scream, I got, what are they called? Like a what are those things? A megaphone. I got a megaphone with a siren thing on it. But also I'm like, if I yell into my megaphone, like they're just going to run a mile, right? So I still have that thing and I'm like, try breaking in because I'm just going to yell the whole street. I can't wait to use it. Anyway, get one.
I have a German Shepherd. So even when my husband isn't home, there's not a lot of fear. It's also eliminated my fear of walking alone at night because I just switch my brain off and she's my brain. If there's a noise in the bush, she hears it before I do. But isn't that sad that, you know, I need a big, scary dog to go for a walk in down my own street at night?
And I think sometimes men are not aware, and they, in a way, have to be we need to tell them. I remember the fabulous journalist Nina Fennell talking about an exercise she used to do when she was working with, I think they were young men who were drafted into rugby league, and they're trying to do gender awareness workshops with them. I'm not sure how well it's worked, but nevertheless, at least there was an attempt. And she used to do this fantastic exercise with them, and she'd get all the women in the office to come in for this particular exercise, and she'd say to the guys, can you write up on this board everything you do every day to keep yourself safe from sexual assault? And, of course, they looked at her like she was a crazy person. Nothing. What are you talking about? I never even think about it. And then she'd say to the women, okay, can you write on this board everything you do every day to keep yourself safe from sexual assault? And they fill the board with the things that women do. And invariably, when men are exposed to that exercise, they're completely astonished. And I think your book very much revealed with that question, that was another way of doing that, of, you know, demonstrating to the men of the town. How women live in the world. And it's one of the reasons I think crime fiction has become so important to women and so centrally controlled, really, by women. I mean, in your novel, you have two female voices and they both feel like outsiders. Quinn has just arrived and is working at a new station, but Ashley is... Well, tell us about Ashley.
Ashley is a very funny, very down-to-earth woman who has been dragged along on this holiday with her husband and his old uni friends, so friends that he met while he was at uni. And these...
Wouldn't we all just look forward to that, ladies?
Yeah, I did think, oh, gosh, if I had to go on a holiday with some of my husband's friends, oh, they're not like these characters. These characters are old money, so they've come from money, and they're quite unlikable, unpleasant characters, which were so much fun to write. so they've always grown up with everything being handed to them. They've sort of lived that golden life. When they do something wrong, it just gets taken care of. It just sort of gets, swept away, and they've never really had to deal with the consequences of it. And Quinn has recently made some money through a business that she's started up, and they have finally deemed Quinn and her husband, Ashley and her husband, as being worthy enough to attend this annual holiday of partying and hedonism and terrible behaviour.
It is quite terrible behaviour.
Mm. You capture in that something that we don't often write about in Australian fiction of any kind, really, but particularly in crime, which is class differences, because what you're really talking about there is the old money versus the new money and the insecurity that goes along with the new money. And it's not just Ashley's, it's also her husband, who's trying desperately hard to be part of this.
And it's also interesting the insecurity that comes with the old money and the competition and the rivalries that come from having these decades-old friendships, and you have come, a lot of the time from the same place, and then across the years you might take different paths, and then you end up in these, completely different spots, and then when you come back together, be it, once a year or, more infrequently than that, I think the differences in your lives and the decisions you've made are laid bare, and it's so easy to... to feel this insecurity and this competition and resentment. And I really was interested in exploring that, that concept of adult envy and, this person's
the bigger
house.
You capture that very well.
Yeah. Thank you.
And the loneliness that attends that, because all of those people who Ashley and her husband at the beginning, her husband more than Ashley, kind of envy and aspire to be like. As we get to know them, we realise they're the most miserable bunch of people because they're incredibly alone. They are constantly, all the time, measuring themselves against the other person. Are they more successful than I am? Are they more beautiful than I am? Are they thinner than I am? Are they, blah, 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 blah. And that means you're always this totally isolated person pretending to be something you're not. Yeah. That really struck me, and I thought you got that across really strongly.
Thank you. And I really loved exploring as well the concept of everyone having their place in these friendship groups and how that changes and how that can impact. So, Ashley and her husband never had money, and so his group of friends, that was just the way it was, and they felt better than him because they had the money and they were confident in, in their status in life. And then once they made just as much money, if not more, they were sort of out of their box in the friendship, and they were on on the same level as them, and that was incredibly threatening.
Yeah, well, you communicate that really well. And you have three voices in yours too.
Sorry, hang on.
you know what I'm doing, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, and I meant to put my shoes in the washing machine before I came. I can't think with them on.
Oh, right. Okay, that's fine.
Okay, yes.
I like the idea of thinking with your feet. You've got Dove, obviously, whose voice is extremely strong, clear. You've got Noah, and you've got his daughter.
Bella.
That's right. Thank you. Slipped my mind for a minute. And I'm really interested why those three. And also, you have written in the voice of a man. And we're talking about this as women and crime, etc. Yeah. So I'm interested in unpacking why you chose that.
Yeah.
And also, Bella is very... I found her very compelling. She was a wonderful, terribly sad, but also really great teenage character.
Thank you, Jane. Yeah, so Noah is a small town electrician. He and his high school girlfriend, she fell pregnant in grade 12, and he had always had dreams of getting out of, you know, the usual small town thing, and kind of found himself a little bit trapped in this. He got married and he is really living a life that he doesn't want to be living, to have another small child. So Bella is 15 at the time of the story, and her chapters are told through a diary entries. In terms of writing a man, you know, like I'm never going to know whether I get that experience right or not. I really think, even though hand on heart, I never ever draw off any specific story I've ever learnt as a psychologist, I feel like I have internalized the voices of so many men who are in distress or who are coming to me with the most intimate personal things. You know, I see them cry all the time. I see them angry. I see them everything, you know, they're like filled with shame, admitting shame. And I think it's just inside me now. And it just came out onto the page. And I don't know, I will never have got it right for every man. I don't know if I've got it right at all, but that's what was sitting there for me. And the first man that I handed a copy of my book to in real life is somebody that I really care about. But he looked at the book, just read the front cover and turned it over and read the blurb. And he handed it back to me and he said, "You're provoking good men with that question." And then he proceeded to launch into this diatribe, which was like, I was like, job done, you've just said everything that's in the book. Yeah, and that's somebody I care about, as I said. But
How fascinating, because I was very impressed with one of Hannah Gadsby's fabulous shows, I can't remember which one it was, where she talked about good men. And she said, actually, you don't get to decide if you're a good man. We get to decide if you're a good man. And I thought, she's right.
Do you know what? I do love that. However, I know we throw this around about good men. I don't think anyone's good. Like, I don't, like, I'd such a, like, to ascribe that characteristic to any human, like, do I think some people are 100% bad? Look, there's some people who are pretty edging into that.
I think you were getting territory. Me on that.
I was like, look, no, you're, but I don't think anyone is all good or all bad. And I know we don't use it so much with women, do we? Like a good, well, I suppose we do in a different way,
Well, I agree with you, but I think that's why the Hannah Gadsby definition is so good, because she's talking about how you impact us.
Yes.
Do you make us feel good? Do you make us feel safe? Therefore, you are a good man. That doesn't mean you're good all the way through.
Yeah.
But for men to say, I'm a good man, they often mean because I've never actually raped a woman. Sorry, that's a fucking low bar.
Yeah.
To give yourself a pat on the back for. So I thought she made a really strong point that it's really more about, you know, who cares whether you're good unless you actually pass that goodness out and
the
share
goodness
it with
is
others.
Determined by the perceiver rather right. than the or experiencer
yes.
of your behaviour. Yeah.
And it's subjective and different for everyone as well, because what makes a good man might be different for one woman as the next woman.
Yeah. But I think you usually know when someone is a life enhancer, who wants to add energy to the room, who wants to, you know, you feel safe with really quite quickly. You can be mistaken, of course. Coercive controllers are very good at making you think they're like that. But nevertheless, we do have an instinctive understanding of someone who's safe to be around, I think.
You know, you reminded me of something that happened in Sydney here a little while ago. For me, it wasn't a big thing, but it was a man that I really like and I really feel safe around. And he just made this throwaway comment. And I was like, huh, you what? And it just, like, I you know how you think you've got someone's vibe?
Mm.
And I was just like, is that really what you think underneath that? And it was just slipped through. And I would say he, you know, I still think he is a good man, but it unsettled me.
Mm.
And I remember, you know, sometimes when I'm working with young men, I think this is going okay. And then something will come out of their mouth and I'm like, is that really what you think? And then I think, what else is under there? And but sometimes I don't know that it's just encoded inside from,
yeah,
you know, that it's not necessarily an intentional harm, but it does stop me sometimes when I think, oh, we're making some progress, but
you remind me of the scene in Adolescence of the teenage boy standing over the psychologist.
I've been told about Adolescence. I don't watch TV. I don't watch movies. So people have to tell me about this stuff. But yeah, right. Yeah.
I haven't braved that one yet.
Haven't? No.
It's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's well worth it. And the best episode, I thought, was the psychologist episode, without a doubt. And as a psychologist, I think you...
Is this the shootery one?
No. Oh. It's a kid who...
Oh, yeah.
Murders a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
It's brilliantly done. It's interesting too, you were talking about, do women get called good women? They do, but it usually means they're women who do what they're told.
Yeah.
Conventional women. But the one thing I find really annoying, we're moving off your books a little bit, except that all the protagonists, female protagonists in your book are... would be described this way, but I detest this description, and that is the description strong women. When women are, she's a strong woman, oh, but you're a strong woman, because the implication of that is that to be a strong woman is unusual. Most women are weak, because you never hear a man called strong unless he actually works in the circus.
Yes, that's so true. That is so true.
I've never thought of that before.
Yep. Whenever anyone says you're a strong woman, I go, no, I'm just a woman. We're all like this.
You know how you did describe yourself
truly
before that I love? You're like, I'm a straightforward woman. I'm like, yeah, that you are, Jane.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that that is something that comes across in your books as well, that the female characters in your book, complicated, self-doubting, you know, not necessarily the two other women at the retreat. They are, you can sort of feel a terrible sympathy for them because they're so caught up in having to live up to this. I kept thinking of that ghastly woman who was at the Met Gala. She's married to Jeff Bezos, Lauren Sanchez, as being like your two female, you know, that they have to create a kind of Barbie doll image of themselves that has nothing to do with being a human.
They're just as trapped,
yes,
as anyone else, if not more so, by the image and the money and the lifestyle and everything that goes along with their husbands' lives.
And the frantic fear of trying to hold on to that.
Yes. And forever feeling it's going to be ripped away from them because they don't have the control.
And they're going to get older. Doesn't matter how much shit they put on their face or in their face. Look at their hands. An absolute giveaway. Now, we're going to go to questions from the audience in a minute. You can look at mine if you like. That's a giveaway, mind you.
That's pretty good.
You can look at my face and that's a giveaway too. I wanted to ask you this one last question before I throw it to the audience. As professionals working in crime in your day jobs, what do you think is the purpose of violence? Are human beings just not very nice?
Jeez, Jane, that's a big one.
Hang on, hell yeah, crime writers. So we should think about that. What is the purpose of violence? What's it for?
So many things. To get one's way, to protect oneself, to express an emotion. Mm. Oh, so many things.
Mm. Be interesting to know evolutionary wise what the you know what the meaning behind the emotion and the expression of violence is, because I'm assuming there's been violence throughout the entirety of humanity.
And we're not the only animals that are violent.
Exactly.
Exactly. Mm.
Yeah, and I mean, if you look at, yeah, like there's violence around, I mean, it's biological really when you get to that level, isn't it? Like protection of your mates, of your resources.
Territory. But in the modern
territory, yeah. Mm. But I think, you know, there are a very small portion of humans that simply enjoy violence also.
And yet I think we all kind of live with a knowledge that violence exists. It exists within us and without us, and that, you know, you can't kind of turn away from it. And in many ways, controlled violent impulses, the anger, that can be very energizing. And if you're going to ask me what the last 50 years of feminism have been about, it's very much about women getting in touch with their own anger and their own, if you like, violent emotions, not necessarily violent physical behavior, though that can happen too, but that part of themselves that we're always told to bury. Mm. And what we're trying to do maybe as feminists now at this point, don't think we've been very successful yet, is to get men to get more in touch with their nurturing, vulnerable, softer side. And because I think when you're not allowed to get in touch with your own vulnerability, you're not allowed to admit it or express it, and, you know, I'm not going to give any spoilers away, but there are male characters in your book for whom vulnerability is shameful, and their response to the shame is to literally destroy the person who caused them that shame.
Or themselves.
Or themselves, and themselves often. And so we are trying in a weird way to save men by saying to them, if only you could admit that vulnerability and own it, you wouldn't need to go and destroy other people, because you wouldn't need to be ashamed of it.
It's just as damaging for men. And you can see it in the high, you know, self-harm and death by suicide rate.
The murder rates, the suicide, all of that. Anyway, this has been such a light and airy conversation, as is so often the way when you're discussing crime novels. But we'll throw it open to you guys. Please don't hesitate and think my question's a stupid one, because then you're definitely doing that bloody conventional female thing, which is so deeply irritating.
Hey, before we go to questions, I have to tell a light story. I have to get this out because it's
really exciting. Sorry.
Can I do it? Can we just wait? I had
hold that
thing happen, right? The other night I was in Mullaney and at a festival, and it was like 11 o'clock at night, and it was like Friday night, I had no reception, but I got this text message come in, and it was from a friend, and she had read Dove, and she's like, Georgia, and we don't know each other super, super well, but she's like, all I could think about when I was reading that, she's like, I just had, you know, the song Rhiannon from Fleetwood Mac. I just had that in my head the whole way through the book. And I was like, you're joking. And then I run around like trying to find a sliver of reception in Mullaney to find a chapter, the very first sample chapter of Dove that I sent to my agent and my publisher that I never used, and has got no. And it like literally talks about Rhiannon and Dove and links the two together. And I'm like, that is so wild. Think about all of the songs in the world, like to have a song playing, let alone that specific song that was there. Anyway, I was just like, how wild is that? I think it's
rare. You're a good communicator, and it came through the pores of your skin.
Maybe.
I've got a question.
Yes.
So about strong women and good men, my particular unfavourite is feisty women.
Oh,
any
God.
Any comments?
If anyone calls me feisty again, I'm going to punch them in the nose.
Jane's very violent.
But it's a good
yes,
point.
Yes, and they'll deserve being punched in the nose. Fuck them.
What's the male version of feisty?
I don't. There isn't a male version of feisty. No. It's why it's so patronising. It's, oh, isn't she cute? Look at her behaving. It's like a kitten, yeah. You know, trying to bite yeah. back. It's
she's
so
a little spitfire.
Patronising.
Mm. It is.
And it's interesting how often coercive controllers, having done quite a lot of research because of the mother, and you would know this very well, how often coercive controllers don't pick timid, passive, quiet women. They pick spirited, feisty women, and there's therefore the fun in breaking them down and destroying them. It's a good question, feisty women. Blah. Come on, somebody else. Yes, up the back.
I've got a very loud voice. I can probably do it without it. Thank you.
I was interested in your discussion about why women like crime and true crime and novels and things, and I really like the concept that it's partly about safety and learning. But I also wondered whether there was sort of it was broader than that. I often think that women are very clever, and often crime stories, novels, there's a lot of thinking involved and a lot of guessing and a lot of I don't know. So I wondered whether maybe it's also because it's quite challenging and intellectual, as well as just a safety protection thing.
What else, cheeky babes?
Us difficult women.
Yes. What do you think?
Go there.
Now you've got to.
I'm just trying to.
I see where you're going, but I don't know because I think are men not equally intellectual? I guess would be no. Okay, so.
Did you shake your head?
I said no.
You said no. Okay.
Sorry. There's one man in the audience. I feel a bit bad. Oh, there's two men.
Mercedes. I'm deferring that.
Oh gosh. Maybe there is an element of that of you know solving the crime and getting there before the protagonist. Yeah.
It's funny though. It doesn't resonate with me because I don't plot mine in advance. So I have a vague. I have an idea. I have a vague idea of how it might end. I've usually got some idea of who did it, and then I've got absolutely no idea how I'm going to get from there to the end until I get there. And I enjoy that because people will pop up and things will happen. I go, oh. I never knew they were a twin. That's fascinating. You know, whatever it is. And so I don't know that that's an intellectual pursuit. I actually think that's more in the gut, really. It's coming.
It's more inquisitive.
I don't know if – I don't think men and women are actually very – I don't think we're very different, yeah. To be honest with you. We've been socialised to be
– I need to Google that. I'm really curious about it.
I'm inquisitive. I need to know. Sorry, carry on, everybody.
Well, the reason I say that I don't think men and women are very different is, after all, we share about 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees. So we can't be that bloody different from men, can we, frankly?
Question. So, yeah. You know, we're talking about men's violence, but why do women not write about women's violence?
I am at the moment, but don't go any further with that one, yeah, because that's a spoiler.
I did a thing with another author called Liz Evans, and she had done her PhD looking at writing crime about, look, it was, yeah, portraying women who are violent or unstable, I suppose. And I think that's often how it's portrayed, that the violence is often linked to sort of like some sort of unhinged mental instability. But I also wonder if it's because female violence occurs at such low rates compared to men. But yeah, I think it's a fair point. I wonder whether there would, yeah, it's probably a good idea. So, but are you doing it? You're doing it.
Sort of. Well, if you read Agatha Christie, there's a lot of female murderers in Christie. So she was a very equal opportunity bad guy kind of an author, and she loved the poisoning because, of course, she was an expert at that. So I think it – but I do think it is partly that it's not so usual. But it is interesting doing the other way around, which I'm kind of playing with at the moment.
I guess for me and sort of my background and my experience is that I see it predominantly perpetrated by men, and so I guess that's in my head when I write, and that comes more naturally because I've been exposed to it more often. And where I sit in the office, I sit right next to our victims of crime team, and so they work with victims of the perpetrators who are in prison. And so, you know, that team will let, you know, this victim know that their perpetrator has been, you know, is being released onto parole next week, or has, you know, moved prisons, or has moved into the next stage of his sentence. And, you know, unfortunately they've got no psychologist or social worker training, and they're often expected to step into that role. And predominantly the vast majority of things I overhear is male violence, and it's women fearful that their perpetrator's coming back out and putting in the exclusion zones of, you know, where he's not allowed to go, but keeping it broad enough so he doesn't know exactly where, you know, what shop she's going to be at or where she lives.
Yeah. I think too the statistics would say that men are actually more likely to be the victims of violence than women are.
Correct, yeah.
But almost entirely at the hands of other men. So the problem with writing about women's violence, it's really interesting, and I'm kind of enjoying exploring it, because it's not like it never happens, but it is so rare in comparison to violence perpetrated by men that I guess for readers it can be a visceral experience reading about violence against women. It's cathartic because something similar has happened to them or happened to people they know. And violence perpetrated by women, mothers against children, definitely. And I think there's more of a... that's more common in literature, I think, that kind of violence. I can't write anything where children get hurt. I'm a complete wuss on that one, so I can't go there. Another question.
I'm not sure if this is accurate, talking about women's violence, but I can think of a couple of examples. One's the author Sandra Hall, who's written quite a number of books, one in particular about a female murderer in New South Wales. And then also thinking, I can't think of her name, but the Mushroom Lady, who's so yes. famous, of course.
Helen Garner and two other authors have written about her.
So there's quite a lot of true crime stuff written for sure, but probably less.
Thinking about those murders, perhaps the murders that women are committing are more targeted, are they, than the crimes that men
it's
are?
It's rare to have a female serial killer, for example. It just has happened, but it's rare.
Yeah.
I think you're right, and I think also the techniques that women use, because they're not physically strong, tend to be things like mushrooms or shooting.
Yeah.
I would say probably the I would guess at, you know, violence from women towards children is probably undetected some of the time, but children are a more vulnerable victim group and more likely to receive the type of violence. It's like a reactive violence out of frustration or substance abuse or whatever. Not that is not excusing that at all, but I think that type of violence, certainly murder is, there's specific methods for women. Female serial killers typically, not always, not exclusively, like the nurses kind of, but you often see work in conjunction with a man together. And I think violent
offences... The Rosemary Wests of the
world. Yes, exactly what I was just thinking about. And, you know, we've had at least one unpleasant one in Australia. Anyway, but I think as well you see some reactive violence from women in domestic violence or intimate partner violence situations, where it's quite common that there is some co-occurring violence on both sides. And it's kind of a complex issue, but it's a really interesting. We need to do another session.
Yes, it'd be a very. But you, you could find some books where it has been explored, I think, violence by women, and it is a really interesting place to go.
And if I may interrupt, if you're interested in hearing a continuation of the conversation, Bad will be back in Blackheath next month with Jane Caro again, Catherine Jinks, Mark Tedeschi, Michael Duffy, Tara Moss, Ava Barry, Michael Duffy and Gary Sturgis. Ladies, thank you so much for an incredible conversation. If we could give a round of applause.
Thank you to Georgia and Mercedes, not just for this lovely conversation, but also for their splendid books, of which they will be signing and selling, but unfortunately there are none of mine. So,
but you can get her
hard being
W.
A bestseller.
Yeah. Yeah. If you go to Big W, apparently the sales assistant will take
it. She'll take you right there. Thank you, Felix and Catherine and Bad, for having us, and Jane, of course.
No worries. We did in fact find out today when our sales partner for the books, Abby's today, were like, oh, we have one copy of Jane's book to bring, and I'm like, one? Like we've sold out.
Thank you, Abby, for coming and selling our books.
Now we do have the raffle to draw. Is there anyone, while the payment system earlier was being a bit of a butt, that didn't get a chance to buy a raffle ticket who would still like to? Beautiful. I'll give you guys a couple of seconds to come down to our volunteers and grab some raffle tickets. And we will draw shortly. So holding music.